Now, City Affairs Committee will please come to order. Please call the roll, see who's here and who's not.
Representative Millet.
She is excused.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Here.
Representative Gaddis.
Here.
Representative Hughes.
Here.
Representative Isaacson.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Chair Lynn.
Here. Okay, everybody, today on the agenda, we have governor's appointments for the State Commission for Human Rights and also for the Board of Parole. And so, do we have Krista Bruce Cottrey online? Are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Yeah, good. Help me, I may have mispronounced your last name. Would you please introduce
yourself? Krista Bruce Cottrey.
Again, please?
Cottrey. Krista Bruce
Cottrey.
But Krista Bruce is fine.
Cottrey. Okay, great. Okay, please introduce yourself for the record. Jeez. And tell us about yourself and why you might like to be on the Human Rights Commission.
I'd be happy to do that. Good morning. I was born in Colorado to a lawyer family, and I subsequently married one who brought me to Alaska in 1968. My mother said, you know, she'd never see me again, but my father said, well, if he were 20 years younger, he'd be there too. And I've never regretted coming. But for over 40 years or so, I taught in the public schools and served as adjunct for the university. It's been wonderful to be a part of so many lives. But since the last confirmation hearing, I have just moved from development work at the Ketchikan Medical Center Foundation to the Alaska Health Education Center in Ketchikan. That's AHEC. And it identifies and supports training for young and old, rural and urban, and health-related careers from Ketchikan to Yakutat. I also facilitate clinical rotations for University of Washington medical students in the area, and I hope to motivate other high school students in the area to replicate the HOSA program that exists here in the high school. I am a gubernatorial appointee to both the Alaska Humanities Forum and the State Commission for Human Rights. It's been an honor to serve the people of Alaska. I have found the Human Rights Commission exceptionally professional as it hones in on the rights of citizens. It's reassuring to know that when someone calls the commission, they immediately get a real person on the other end of the phone. I've seen firsthand the diligent, well-researched work the staff does for the people of Alaska. We can be proud that they work for us. I'm happy to answer any questions you have. Do you have any?
Very good. You're going for the Human Rights Board. Well, what do you think?
Yes, I'm currently serving on the board now.
Yeah. Well, since you have experience on the board, what has been the common denominator of most of the work that you do? Without names, of course, but I mean, what general type of cases have you worked on? Is there a common denominator of the folks that come before you?
I would say we don't see a lot because most of the research is done before us. So by the time it gets to us, it's at the point where we've had questions of discrimination, mostly, I guess I would say that's the general term for what I have actually seen since I've been on the board.
Okay, any other questions for, yes, Representative Hughes.
Yes, thank you for joining us today, and I enjoyed hearing your background information. On the top of the form that I have in my packet, it says, the Board of Regents. Were you originally seeking a seat on that board?
Yes, I was, and I hope maybe eventually to serve there, but they called me, maybe because of my background, and asked if I'd like to serve on the Human Rights Commission, and because of my background and family and so forth, it seemed like a good fit, and I've been honored to serve, yes.
Okay, thank you. So you are happy then with that seat as opposed to the Board of Regents, it sounds like.
Well, yes, I am. But if the board, you know, the Board of Regents has 8-year terms, and if that were to come around at some point, I'd love to do that. But certainly now I'm very happy to serve on the Human Rights Commission. It's important work.
Thank you.
And you said some cases, what type of discrimination were they in general? Racial discrimination, sexual discrimination?
No, I would say more, to be generic, more disabilities, differences, kind of thing, perceptual discrimination because of, you know, race, gender, lifestyle, that kind of thing.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Reverend Isaacson.
Thank you. And thank you, Krista, for being here. I'm not sure exactly how to frame the question, but the Human Rights Commission, of course, is an important one when it comes to dealing with the issues you just described. But up in the Fairbanks area in the Goldstream, I used to live in that area and used to go to the Goldstream store quite a bit. And it seems like there's a lot of contention revolving around the decision of the Human Rights Commission on that. Some look at it as protecting a person's lifestyle. Another is saying it infringed upon the right of a business owner to conduct his business as he saw fit, and for other reasons than what was brought up. I'm just looking here for how, when you get these type of things coming before you, what is your thought process as you move through trying to determine what is the real issue of each case? What's your thought? And I notice that you're well-educated, and so I know you have a good thought process, probably. But could you describe it?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I don't know what you're referencing because I wasn't involved. But I will say that for me personally, I wanted myself to be convinced that the Human Rights Commission processes were appropriate and that they follow the law and so forth. And I have to tell you that I'm extremely impressed by the way they handle things. The way they handle people, they're tremendously overloaded from what I can see, but they are genuinely, they have their protocols, policies, and procedures in place, and they follow them. So once I felt confident with them as an entity, I would say that the next question for me personally is, you know, constitutional rights, and that's not just for individuals, it's for businesses as well. I don't see any biases. I see here's the law, and here's the facts. And I think they try very hard to ferret out the facts. In fact, there's something that happened relatively recently where the commission went out of its way to accommodate the complainant to make sure that it was fair and equitable. And I've seen that on both the complainants and on the entity that was being sued, if you will. So I guess it's a matter of following the law, and I haven't seen those biases that you might have expected to see.
All right.
Any follow up?
Well, I kind of do, but I
no, go ahead. That's what
I'm not sure exactly how to frame them. They're
go
coming
ahead.
To me in bits and pieces. So I can appreciate that happens when a case comes before you. I'm glad to hear that you're looking at constitutional rights as well. When you talk about constitutional rights, are you framing that in on the basis of what is perceived popular opinion at the time of what our rights should be? I mean, we're having these big things with Second Amendment rights currently in the legislature and so forth. All of our rights seem to be in the process of being reinterpreted. How do you interpret constitutional rights?
That's a topic for a long discussion, but fundamentally I have to admit that I followed constitutional law in the state of Alaska for a very long time, and I have a background that makes me very proud of the long-standing hard work that people have done, that what makes our country what it is today and why we have succeeded as an institution for so long, and why we are successful when other countries seem to be struggling. So So I'm very protective of you know, those fundamental rights that we have. And I've watched as people look at the state constitution, which I think we've done a very good job with. And I think, I don't know that I'm answering the question, but I think that I want to honor the intent of our state constitution, and the intent of individuals to pursue their dream, without being impinged upon by other people. You know, within reason. That's, I don't know. We need to talk for a long time.
Go ahead.
And I appreciate that. When it comes to, here's part of the frustration that I have is, when it comes to the right of an employer to, who has bootstrapped themselves, to conduct business as they see fit, whether it's they have religious intentions, or they just want to do public service, or they have pure capitalism, whatever their intent. Sometimes you get employees who come around and feel that the job is entitled, they're entitled to the job. They haven't put any skin in the game, but they're working there. And sometimes we get people who feel that there's an entitlement for them, and so they find reasons to keep the job, and so we have seen businesses topple and everyone lose their jobs when there's issues of employee entitlement instead of an employee just moving on to find a job that better suits them or something. How would you judge between these cases? What's your thought process on this, or am I just totally out in...
Well, I, you know, you're keenly aware of what's at the heart of the issues we wrestle with. And one thing that was before the commission when I first came aboard was just one of those things. Is this really frivolous on this person's part? You know, is it really valuable for this individual to pursue what they did and put, you know, stab the larger entity, the business, if you will? And I don't think we don't need to treat things frivolously. And I think that the Human Rights Commission did a real good job in letting this individual know that, you know, that there maybe is a better fit for you. So I think I understand what's at the core of your concern, and I would say that, you know, I do look at something if it's frivolous. And not for the good of all, you know, in the long term. I like to hope that the decisions that we make are good ones in the long term, not just for a specific instance.
Thank you. And one last thing, Mr. Sure. Chair. I would hope that as you serve on this commission, you remember that what you were just saying, because when you fine a business a fine and it appears to be, well, a business can swallow the expense, but when that fine is to a small business in a rural area that doesn't have the ability to pay it, they don't have deep pockets, and the business closes down, no one benefits. Everyone loses, because now the employer is gone. The other individuals who relied on the business are out of a job, and all in the name of protecting one person. It's very important to protect people's rights, but it's important to delineate the greater picture as well, and make fines appropriate, perhaps, if fines are required, and not just looked at as if it was everyone's in a big urban area and business can swallow every expense, because that's just
true. I respect that. What I have seen on things that I've been involved with is there was an instance where it was right and appropriate to let the business know that they needed to handle things a little differently. And we guided the business and told them that. But at the same time, I think respecting and protecting the rights of the individual. So it's always a balancing act, and hopefully when they come out of this process that they're both wiser than they were. Their communication skills were better, and they worked hard at resolution. Because that's what we all want. We want to handle things wisely and appropriately, and we try to do that.
Well said. Thank you.
What on the fines, how do you determine what the fine is? Is there a schedule of fines based on what happened?
I don't actually know the answer to that. I've not been involved.
What do you mean? Are we looking?
I don't know.
I guess one of us would get in trouble talking about $100 or $1,000 or $10,000.
I don't think that I haven't been on the commission in a situation long enough to know. I personally have not been involved in any remuneration or compensation or anything like that. I don't know.
Okay, we may follow up on this later. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Chair Lynn. And I concur with Representative Isaac's concern, and I appreciate your balance and understanding both the employer and the employee are people who have human rights, and business owners need to be considered too, so appreciate that. I was intrigued that you had a project on social justice, and so on your application is something you did during your career. And so I was just wondering if you could speak to your definition of social justice, and I wouldn't mind learning what your project was about. And then also, I see that in March 2012, you had a confirmation hearing. So to be clear, are you presently serving, and were you confirmed last March in 2012? And so are these only one-year terms?
No, I serve on the Human Rights Commission as well. I serve on the Alaska Humanities Forum as well, so I'm not quite sure about that date situation. My term, I think, is 2 years, or I might have been filling a term, I'm not sure.
It says here, Alaska State Commission for Human Rights Commission confirmation hearing March 1st, 2012, so that was an error?
I am embarrassed to say I may have been filling another person's term, and am now going for my own term. I think that's the situation.
Okay. Well, if you could please speak to the social justice question.
Sure. I was invited by the State Department to Azerbaijan. And in Baku, which sits on the Caspian Sea, I was involved with students trying to talk about social issues. And to encourage some online conversations with American kids in Alaska on just to talk about their life. And I think as often is the case when we have these exchanges, and I set up computers over there and help them facilitate these online conversations. The ultimate goal is to better people's understanding of America, I think. And remember, this is a post-Soviet democracy, and I've actually been in several post-Soviet democracies, and you can't really appreciate so much what it means to come from that history. So we had high school kids linked with high school kids in Baku, and they talked about issues that were important to them, daily life, and hopefully the conversations, I have them somewhere. It didn't last very long because the infrastructure in Baku was such that, you know, they had the area where the computers was a beautiful display area that they'll show you in, and they'll take you in. It's like in the old days in China when they would take you to a selected camp or commune. This is the one we'll demonstrate with. But when you went to every other room in the school and the bathrooms, it was just beyond the word that's at the tip of my tongue, which I really shouldn't use, appalling conditions. So the infrastructure was not sufficient for it to be a sustaining program. But I think we did interact with, I would guess, probably 15 or 20 kids directly in the high school in Azerbaijan and Baku, and with about twice that many here at Ketchikan High School.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? I'd like to thank you very much for applying. We will consider forwarding your name. along with the others. And again, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We have, I assume that the folks have been listening in on the previous question, so you might be prepared for some of the same thing. Do we have Jason Hart?
Victor? Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm on the line. So my name is Jason Hart. I'm born and raised in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm an Athabascan. My family is originally from Chittenden, Alaska. I'm also a Menominee Indian, and that side of my family is originally from Kashina, Wisconsin, a little reservation near Green Bay. I'm interested in serving both the state of Alaska as well as my Otna people. The Human Rights Commission has a rich history, and I would be honored to be confirmed for service on that commission. In terms of my qualifications, I have a master's degree in business, a bachelor's degree in business management, and an associate's degree in mechanical and electrical technology. I'm currently working at Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. For those of you who don't know, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium co-manages the Alaska Native Medical Center, the largest Indian health service facility in the United States. I currently work for the chairman and president doing special projects at ANTHC. I previously managed the benefits department where I oversaw a multi-million dollar self-insured health plan as well as the recognition rewards program and our retirement plan. In that capacity, as the individual managing the benefits department, I was also the plan administrator for the health plan and handled final appeals from plan participants. Some other interesting facts about me, I served 7 honorable years in the Air National Guard, and I was recently appointed to the Zoning Board of Examiners and Appeals by Mayor Dan Sullivan, and I was also confirmed by the Municipal Board, essentially. So I hope the committee will push me forward for confirmation, and I appreciate you listening to me, sir.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your reply. Any questions for the gentleman? Isaacson, you're
Thank
looking
you, Mr.
at
Chair. Well, I suppose we should ask each of them the question.
I think it'd be good because we have so many questions in the first part, and I think the other folks ought to suffer also.
Well, I appreciate you putting your name forward, Jason, and so the questions that I have, and I used it, used a recent commission decision that in our area was considered controversial. Would you explain your thought process when it comes to ferreting out fact and issues before you? How do you go about thinking through what is right and who is right?
I guess I would say that it's important to have all the facts of the situation and to consider each one of those with equal weight. I would put myself in the place of the individual that is potentially making a complaint or has an issue, and then I would also try to put myself in the shoes of the organization that has a complaint against it, and I guess I would think of it that way and try to make sure that I'm not weighing towards one side or the other, and that I'm really trying to stick middle of the line and stick to the facts of the case.
The follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So what is your standard of right? What do you base it on?
What would I base the decision on?
What is your basis for determining?
How do you define right and wrong?
Yeah.
What is the basis for right and wrong? I think that's really going to depend on the situation, but I think most individuals kind of think the same when it comes to what's right and what's wrong. I mean, if an employer's obviously mistreating an individual and it appears that it's because of that individual's race or because of a disability, then I think we all know that that's wrong. If an employee is, for some reason, taking advantage of an employer, and for some reason or another, I think that there's a lot of things that are going to be pretty clear-cut when you look into the facts of the case.
Would you say definitely right or wrong is relative, or according to the facts of a particular case, or?
Can you repeat that again, Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry, too far back from the mic. Would you say that your definition of right and wrong is relative according to the case, or just the facts of the case, or how would you describe that? Is there a right or a wrong, or is it relative to a particular case?
I think it can be relative to a particular case and the circumstance of that case, as well as the laws for the state of Alaska and the governing documents for the State Commission of Human Rights.
Okay, thank you. Representative Isaacson?
Thank you.
You had some more?
Yes, thank you. And I appreciate your reference now to the laws of state of Alaska and governing documents of the commission, because if you don't have a standard, if you don't know where you're supposed to be at any one time, you will abuse people. Somebody will be treated unfairly, because if it's all relative, then one person gets the benefit of the doubt, whereas another might not. And to that end, one of my questions to the previous applicant was, or appointee, was the idea of entitlement. Sometimes what you said, it isn't clear cut that an employer is discriminating against an employee. Sometimes an employee is just a bad employee and they feel entitled to a job. Now, I'm not saying that's always, and that's why you exist. What's your consideration? How do you ferret out when somebody is using the process to punish an employer? And then how do you, in light of that, how do you look at a more global aspect? What happens to that employer and then to all the other employees if somebody who's using the system prevails? Using it improperly, I should say, prevails.
Well, I think, once again, it would be important to take the facts of the case into consideration. Once again, I would put myself in the place of both the employer and the individual. I think it would also be important to look at previous cases that may have similar circumstances to see how previous commissions had ruled on those, and to take those into consideration as well. The way I would look at the situation is essentially trying to be as objective as possible, even though it's not completely possible in all situations, because it may not be as clear-cut as you would hope it would be. But I think that's why the commission has, I think, 7 members, because it's not always going to be clear-cut, and it's going to be important to take the aspects from multiple people's set of experiences.
All right, fair enough. And one final question.
Go ahead.
Then the last question I asked the previous appointee was on punishment fines. What's your thought process in how to arrive at appropriate fine? And what's the purpose of fines in your estimation?
So from my understanding, I have attended one meeting for the State Commission for Human Rights. I haven't had the opportunity to serve them previously, but from my understanding, the fines are essentially derived from either essentially salaries that the employee for some reason wasn't paid, or essentially things of that nature, a number of days that the employee wasn't able to be at work. So I think there's a very specific formula that the commission has, and I don't think we can essentially come up with arbitrary numbers to fine organizations for unjust treatment of employees. So I think there's a very defined formula that the commission has to come up with fines. So to be honest, I don't think it's necessarily up to the commission as far as how much we can do it. I really think that's going to be defined by the governing documents for the commission, from my understanding.
So these fines would be more compensatory rather than punitive. Is that correct?
From my understanding, yes, Chairman.
Okay. Follow up?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else on the committee? Thank you, sir, for talking to us this morning. We appreciate it. Appreciate your candor.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And next we have Grace Merkis.
Hello?
Yes, are you there? Yes, ma'am. Help me with your last. Introduce yourself and tell us why you'd like to be.
Are you there?
Yes, yes, we are.
Okay, sorry, I'm on my cell phone here. So I just want to thank you, Chairman Lynn, and the rest of the committee for having this confirmation hearing. It sounds like you have a really involved committee there, which is great. And for those of you that don't know me, my name is Grace Merkis, and I've been on the Human Rights Commission for over 10 years. So I have some background, I guess you would have to say, in the Human Rights Commission, and looking for confirmation again. I feel it is very important that some of the Human Rights Commissioners have some history on the commission, and there's some continuity on the commission, which pretty much helps so that we have information on the discrimination law and case process and that kind of thing. My husband is Leon, and we came to Alaska in 1956. We've been married over 50 years. We proved up on a homestead in Sterling, and we raised 8 kids, all of which still live in Alaska, and some of them are, one is in San Francisco. And I think you might have my resume and my application there. I don't have the kind of education the previous two commissioners have given you, but I'd say my experience and education is in real life. I appreciate the eloquence that Commissioner Bruce and Hart have taught in their education. They're really good commissioners, I have to say. Some of the reasons why I want to still be on the Alaska Rights Commission, one is that I think it's very important that discrimination actions need to be investigated. And once they are investigated and there's evidence given, then their conclusion needs to be fair to all. I think one of your members was asking about involvement and bias, and I think it's very important that we are unbiased, number one, but also fair. I also have some background in how the Alaska discrimination law is written, and the process that if the legislators feel that there needs to be a change in the law, then we need to pursue that. I believe, number one, that all people are created equal and that we should be treat them that way. I've been on the Borough Assembly for 17 years. I'm not presently, but I have a lot of experience in making the unbiased decisions after studying the issue, listen to the people, and then make a decision. So quite familiar and comfortable with making unbiased decisions. I also can follow the process that our Human Rights Commission does regarding how they do the investigative stage and then try to mediate an answer before, or an agreement or settlement before it has to go to hearing. So that's one of the good processes that the commission does, I feel. And the other reason, I think it's very important to have the Human Rights Commission available to our Alaska citizens and have a place to go where they can bring their, if they feel like they were discriminated against, bring it to the entity that can investigate it. So those are some of the reasons why I would like to still be on the commission and would really ask for your confirmation for myself to the rest of the body.
Thank you very much for your comments. It all seems to me, you know, education is fine, but if you have to choose between education and common sense, I'll take common sense, which is not always that common. We have a question from Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, thank you, Grace, for your service. I really appreciate it. The 10 years on the commission, I got a little bit of feel for the amount of work you do. I'm on several commissions myself, and I know it takes a lot of personal sacrifice, and thank you. I was just wondering, your experience could be really valuable to us And I was wondering, over the 10 years, you know, do you have a sense that you could give us of a segment of our society that gets most of the discrimination issues arise? I mean, racial, gender, you know, religious. I mean, is there a category like that that leaps forward in your mind? And maybe not, but I'm just really curious if you give us some insight. It'd be nice for us to know.
Yes, I would say, first of all, I'd say that, you know, the commission, I know some of you are pretty new to the or to the group there, but there is an annual report that's given out every year, and on the back page has all that good information about gender, nationality, sex, age, that kind of thing, of what the cases are, and a nice graph of them. But I would say that generally 90% of cases, probably at least, are regarding employment and nationality. And that would, to me, that's probably the biggest cases where we have hearings, where they actually go to hearing. We have sexual kinds of cases regarding gender. And some disability cases, but overall I'd say it's employment and not getting a raise or not getting a job or being discriminated because of certain reasons.
All right, Representative Keller.
Yeah, I just really want to thank you. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, and I want to confess that we get piles of annual reports, and it's really nice to hear it verbally, so thank you.
Oh, sorry about that. It is nice, and in those annual reports, it also gives a little resume or a little short summary of some of the cases, which gives you a good idea of what we're doing.
Thanks.
I guess one of the questions someone was asking there about the fines, and
yes.
Personally, I don't really call them fines, but basically what I understand what they are is based on, and generally, it's employment, and if someone gets fired for certain reasons, a lot of times they call it retaliation. They're retaliated against because they reported some kind of discrimination to the commission. And if they lose their job, then basically they're supposed, according to the law, they're supposed to look for another job, but we have to make them whole until they do find another job. So that's kind of based on how long it takes them to find a job and if they were really looking and what they were getting paid. Then we also apply interest to it, and the interest is also based on the Alaska State Discrimination Law.
Okay, thank you. I'm not sure who it first. Let's go to Representative Hughes.
Yeah, mine will be short because it's a comment. And I just want to thank you. I never apologize for not having an education because I agree with the chair. Your common sense and the fact that you raised 8 kids, you got quite the education. And I believe that you're very valuable in that with your real-life experience. And I just applaud you for that. And I want to thank you, too, for your public service. It's very impressive. And I do think that the institutional knowledge that you would bring to the commission is an important factor. So thank you.
A lot of
thank you for that. If I just could comment about my 8 kids, I also am very proud of them. And they all bring a lot to their community and to, you know, their constituency that they serve, so I'm proud of them myself.
Yeah, I like folks with a PhD from the College of Hard Knocks. Resident Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also agree that you have an impressive resume. Coming from a municipal background myself, I applaud you for your municipal work as well. And in trying to research each one of you to find out if we could figure out thought processes, you actually had something we found on Google that tells me you're a pragmatic sort of person. But if you would, just to be fair, and you know this is a municipal process where we ask every applicant basically the same type of questions, so it's a fair review. and I appreciate the fact that you've been on the commission, and so you can answer some of these better. But out of six of us sitting here, four of us are brand new to the legislature, and so we don't have the history of your service, but I thank you for it. Would you describe your thought process and how you evaluate who is right and what is right?
It's a very it's actually a hard job. You know, number one, we have to follow the law, and there has to be evidence, like the other two commissioners were saying, substantial evidence, and that. But you also have the opportunity to either believe or don't believe what the witnesses are saying, and how truthful are they, and are they only speaking to keep their job, or are they only speaking to support the employer, because generally they're employee job things that we're talking about. And so you have to evaluate those kinds of ideas, I think. And another issue that we did come up with the case, which I think, you know, we have administrative law judges that decide our cases for us, and then we, as commissioners, review the cases, three of us on each case. So there are cases that we know about real thoroughly and cases that we don't know about. And one of them in particular that strikes me that I think was really a good decision was, and I can't exactly say, you know, all the details, but it was based on where the job was, the location, and what kind of a job it was. And the question was sexual harassment. And at that point, I think I can say that because of the job that it was, because of what kind of job it was, that the idea of sexual harassment would be different than if you were in a different location with different people. So, you know, you have to, that to me is kind of using common sense and being reasonable and what really happens in certain kinds of jobs. So those are kinds of things that we have to look at, and, you know, those aren't black and white. So I don't know what else I can say, but I evaluate them very thoroughly and thinking about if I really believe what, you know, what the witnesses are saying.
I would assume in some of these cases come down to a he said, she said kind of
exactly.
Thing.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, somebody's on the telephone saying something, and then, you know, they're in the next room. Did they really hear them, or what was it? You know, a lot of that stuff is that way. It's never really, I don't think, black and white. Occasionally it is, but you have to really kind of use your brain and be reasonable about it.
What a concept. Reverend Isaacson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the idea of a standard, you mentioned the attorneys basically present the case to you. What's the basis that you use to determine whether or not even the attorneys are correct? Is there a standard, a basis that you use?
Well, the basis is the Alaska discrimination law. You know, you can't discriminate against people for certain reasons and certain things. And, you know, we have the law to follow. And that's what the attorneys are using. And, of course, they're arguing one way or another to support their idea. But the big thing is you have to have substantial evidence. You know, if there is not substantial evidence, it kind of goes away. And if there is substantial evidence, then it goes to either mediation, where we hire a contractor attorney to mediate between the parties, and if they can't come up with that, some kind of agreement there, then it does go to hearing. It's just like court.
Continue.
Being a jury.
And thank you. So I actually have two more questions. You've answered the thing about the fine, but not everything is cut and dry, and as you said, it can be a very difficult decision. What happens when, how do you ferret out whether or not an employee is just seeking to be keeping their job because they feel entitled to it without necessarily being responsible for it. And the employer then, and no employer is perfect, I suppose, some of us less perfect than others, but what happens, you know, when the process is used basically just to retaliate against an employer and so someone can keep their job? How do you figure that out?
Our only what our Human Rights Commission can only do to help them keep their job is if there was a discrimination. If there wasn't any discrimination, we wouldn't have anything to do with, that would be a labor issue with the Labor Department or somebody. But they have to prove that there's discrimination to keep their job. It would have to be based either on their race, their national origin, their religion, their sex, their marriage, that kind of thing. But if we don't have jurisdiction over some kind of discrimination, then we wouldn't have any reason to even be in the case. And like, it sounds to me like you're saying, you know, the guy just isn't doing a good job, he's just hanging around, but now he's going to go to the Human Rights Commission, and he would have to say he was discriminated somehow. I don't know what he would say.
Well, what if it's the employer may have religious positions and might talk about his or her faith that at his or her workplace, and an employee who has a lifestyle that differs from that religious position feels offended, and so the offense constitutes, and I'm not saying this is any particular issue, but this is a skeleton of a part of one, I suppose, but the you know, this is becoming more and more prevalent, so an offense becomes a perceived discrimination rather than, or I should say the perceived offense becomes it, because they just don't like it and they figure they should have, you know, I mean, they're using the process to get back at the employer, and yet the employer's put sweat, blood, and tears, as you know, you've been involved with business, into building a business so that there's opportunity for employment. How do you help, as you said, before it gets to the hearing phase, how do you help mitigate these issues? How do you ferret out truth in this?
Not talking about any specific case, I would say that if somebody had, the employer had religious issue, or was very religious and was trying to, maybe they're trying to pass their religion on to their customers. I don't know what's happening. But the employee that doesn't like the issue, I don't think he really has a case against the employer, just because he doesn't like it. I guess that's kind of where I would go with that issue.
Okay. All right. And, well, I appreciate your answers and candor, and thanks again for your service.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your prior service and appreciate your comments this morning. Is Christina Bruce available?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Just one moment, please. Okay. Time. Sarah Pocinti, are you available, please?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. Welcome. Thank you for applying for the Board of Parole. Please introduce yourself and tell us why you'd like to be on the Board of Parole and make any comments you'd like to make. We may have some questions for you.
All right. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Sarah Pocinti. I was born and raised in Fairbanks. I went to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where I obtained a bachelor's degree in justice and a bachelor's degree in social work. I then worked as a probation officer for the state of Alaska for almost 12 years. I worked in the field for 8 of those years. supervising inmates who were released back into the community. During that time, I primarily supervised sex offenders who lived in urban and rural areas, working with treatment providers, setting up safety plans for them to be in the community, and so the community was safer. I then went and worked in the institution as a probation officer, and during that time, I worked closely with the Aquila Treatment Center. They started a substance abuse treatment program while for inmates who were incarcerated to complete intensive outpatient treatment, and I worked closely with inmates to get them into that treatment and see them through that process. 2 years ago, I was confirmed to the Board of Parole to finish a previous board member's term, and so I've been on the board for the past 2 years. I enjoy being on the board. I think I bring a good perspective in terms of working in the field and working in the institution closely with inmates who live in the community and inmates who are incarcerated for long periods of time. And I would appreciate the opportunity to be confirmed again for another appointment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the applicant, Representative Keller?
Yeah, sir, I just again want to thank you for your long experience and work on behalf of the parole board. I just want to invite you, when you see things, you know, that we can maybe take another look at in the area of parole, I just would welcome you at least to my office, and I'm sure all my peers here would say the same. You know, to give us insights and how we can improve it. Obviously, the projected number of people incarcerated is projected to grow, and there's going to be a greater emphasis, I think, on the parole board. And so I just wanted to encourage you to talk to us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Any other questions? Representative Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Sarah. I believe we all received a letter just with expressing concern about the makeup of the parole board and those with knowledge of Alaska Native issues and rural issues. So I was just wondering if you could provide, I noticed that you've done some training related to those issues, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to express your knowledge and understanding of those issues and how that might fit into your seat on the board.
Yeah. And before you answer, I would tell you that we do have representative of the ACLU online. I assume he's online, and he may want to make some comments at some portion of this hearing. I just wanted to tell you that before you made your comments. Go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. Yes, as I stated, I was born and raised in Alaska, so I'm not Alaska Native. I do have an appreciation for the issues that are prevalent for the Alaska Native community. As a board, we do have that sensitivity to Alaska Natives in terms of when we look at releasing them and they live in, remote areas where there's not always treatment programs available. And so it's tough sometimes if they haven't done treatment in the institution and then they want to go back to a remote area. I think in terms of the Department of Corrections, that's getting better. There is a big commitment from the commissioner in terms of education and programming while inmates are incarcerated, so that when they do get released, they've met some of those rehabilitation programs so that they can then parole back to the community that they are from, or, where they were living at the time or where their family lives. When I was a probation officer, I supervised inmate or, you know, inmates who were released who lived here in Fairbanks and who lived in surrounding areas in different villages, and worked closely with, you know, VPSOs, the village safety officers, so that there were safety plans set up so that they could then live back in their communities. And but there are times when they have to do some type of programming, maybe in an urban area, before then they go back to their community, and we try to work with them in terms of housing. You know, there's a lot of different programs that they can get into in the urban areas for kind of housing so that they could do their treatment, so then they can then go back to their communities. And I think we take all of that into consideration when we're looking at paroling somebody, you know, in general, not just Alaska Natives, but in general, we look at all of that, you know, but we are sensitive to the Native population in terms of housing and where they live and treatment programs. I know there's a big push for treatment, and sometimes based on, you know, where they're from, where they've lived, sometimes it's harder for them to then get through treatment programs. And I know when I was a probation officer and I worked closely with a sex offender therapist here in Fairbanks, we did a lot of specialized treatment for Alaska Natives, because there are quite a few sex offenders who are Alaska Native who then can benefit from the treatment, but sometimes the treatment programs, you know, aren't then based, you know, it's just sort of a kind of a blanket treatment. And I work closely with the treatment provider here in Fairbanks to, you know, base some of the treatment on what their understanding was and then how things would look for their safety plans when they went back to the rural area that they were from. So we do take that into consideration when we're making decisions.
And I'd like to add, I assume this is not based on race or ethnicity. I would assume this is based on, you know, the community where they're from, the challenges they might have in their particular community, the individual person background and so on, rather than race itself. So the challenges, you know, we all face challenges. Some are different than others. I assume this is what you're looking at rather than a person's actual race. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. We look at all that, and certainly there's a lot of people who live in rural areas who are Alaska Native, and we, you know, we take all of that into consideration. And when we're making decisions, we, you know, base our decisions on the risk that the inmates, you know, may have and what they've done to reduce the risk in terms of programming and treatment and, you know, safety plans for when they get out.
Okay, I could follow up, but I may delay on that. Representative Hughes, I believe you had a question.
Yes, I just have a follow-up. Thank you, Sarah. Because a number of us are new here, and just to better understand, as you're making decisions regarding an individual, are you following specific guidelines and statutes and regs, or do you have quite a bit of flexibility as far as those decisions? And then also, I was wondering how much you interface with workforce opportunities for those being released. Is there anything that, as you set out the criteria that involves job seeking and referrals, that kind of thing?
Yes, when we sit down to do, you know, before we see somebody who is applying for parole, You know, there's a, we look at all their backgrounds. You know, there's an application that they complete that includes kind of what their plans are for when they get out. We look at the programs that they've done, how that reflects on their history in terms of reducing their risk. And then after we review all that, we then have a face-to-face interview with them, which is pretty important, doing the face-to-face, because sometimes they aren't, maybe they're not as eloquent, you know, writers, and so then when we can sit down face-to-face with them and ask them questions, ask them, you know, what they've done, what they've learned, what their plans are, they're then better able to let us know and maybe, you know, say it instead of how it's written. And then also there's a lot of nonverbal things that that sometimes you can see when you're talking to somebody who, you know, has been incarcerated for a long time and wants to get out on parole. So that's really important to us. And then your question, we do have, you know, regs and guidelines that we look at in terms of, you know, the crime that they've committed, the time that they've been in, you know, when it is that they can apply in terms of how long they've done, and then kind of what's the standard for someone who has that criminal history, who's committed, you know, the crime that they're in for, you know, when's an appropriate time to start taking a look at them for parole placement. But then we do have some flexibility in terms of, you know, maybe making more of a customized release plan for this person and what it is that they need. And I know you asked about employment also, and then, so, you know, that release plan can then include them going to different programs to continue some of their education. And like I stated earlier in the conversation, you know, there is such a big push right now from Department of Corrections in terms of education and programming that a lot of them are able to either get their, you know, at the lowest level, get their GEDs, and then college courses. You know, there's a lot of different employment opportunities that they can gain while they're in, you know, even working on things and gaining some, you know, hands-on experience with different things. And so we can make plans for a specific person that fits them, as opposed to just making kind of a blanket release plan for everybody. You know, but it is really important that getting that information, getting their background, and then sitting down and talking to them and the probation officer who's worked with them to then make the plan to kind of continue that, the things that they've been working on while they've been incarcerated, to then continue that for when they get out and they're in the community, so that there's not a break, there's not a break in education or programming for them. You know, we try to make it so they continue doing that.
Reverend Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I actually, just to disclose that I was actually involved, was a contractor in the prison system, and actually worked with inmates on getting their GEDs and getting ready for preparing for the workforce and work, helping them with resumes and things like that. So I was involved at that end. So I was curious about the assimilation back into the communities across the state and how important that is, and knowing that a lot do break parole and end up back in the prison, and concerned about that. So I was wondering, and back in, and we do know the numbers of those back to the Alaska Native situation that they are disturbing. And do you have an opportunity as a parole board to make recommendations to help with that assimilation? For instance, I'm thinking there are some nonprofits, faith-based groups, folks out there that are trying to help with that. Do you have interaction with them so that we can try to improve those statistics and not have so many breaking parole?
Yeah, there are a number of programs out there that they can then, you know, kind of parole to different housing opportunities, different places that they can go that help with that, help with some of the things that you probably helped with while you were in the institution that then will continue to help them, such as like the Native Justice Reentry Program in Anchorage, who, you know, can help with that. We do have a housing program that they can apply for that gets them assistance for housing. It'd be nice to see, I guess, more of these programs in the rural areas, you know, but there are different things that can be set up when they're looking at a release plan in terms of people they can check in with in the different villages and, you know, some treatment opportunities that they can do while they're out there. But it is very important to get them connected with some kind of program so that when they get released, they, you know, can go there, as opposed to, I mean, we know a lot of people get released and they go to, you know, the shelters while they're trying to find places to go, and, you know, that's just a tough situation for them. You know, for us, when people apply for discretionary parole to get out earlier, I think that we have a better opportunity to work with the inmate and work with the PO to then get a good release plan so that, you know, like I was saying, it kind of seamlessly gets them out and gets them in the community without that break. And, you know, we know that a lot of parolees end up back in prison, but our discretionary releases, we do have a much lower recidivism rate. I believe between 7% and 9% recidivism rate for the discretionary releases, as opposed to the mandatory parole releases, which we don't see those. They don't come before us for their mandatory parole release. They're just released onto mandatory parole. With the discretionary, we have a lot more interaction, flexibility. You know, we can help get them into the community with some good structure.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to ask you to stay on the line, if you will, because I'm going to call on the next person, and you may have some responses, may not, we'll see. Is Tom Stinson there, please, from the ACLU?
Yes, Chill, and thank you for calling on me and taking my testimony.
Yeah, please identify yourself officially.
Yes, this is Tom Stinson. I'm the legal director at the ACLU of Alaska. I submitted some written testimony, and I'd just like to submit some brief comments.
We are in receipt of a letter from you dated February 27th, and the second paragraph says, the purpose of our letter is intended to prompt discussion of the parole board's general function. Now, parole board members are selected generally, and it says it has nothing to do with Ms. Pacetti personally, and that's one of the comments you make. And as I understand it, the function of the committee meeting this morning is to discuss the qualifications of the applicants for a different parole board and human rights commission and so on, rather than to discuss the general function and so on. And so I was hoping, you know, your comments were for this lady in particular. And also I see on page 2, it says, the ACLU would urge the committee to reject the proposed applicant and push for appointment of members familiar with Daily Bell's life, etc. And I'd just like to make the comment, we do not discriminate against applicants based on race or ethnicity or where they happen to live in the state of Alaska. And so with those comments in mind, would you like to make some of your own?
Certainly. Thank you very much, Representative Lynn. So, again, I'm certainly not asking for the committee to discriminate racially or to discriminate on the basis of ethnicity. Nowhere did I say you have to appoint someone who is Alaska Native in that letter. What I pointed out is that there's a legal requirement, which, as far as I can tell, has not been fulfilled, that the governor shall make appointments to the board with due regard for the representation on the board of the ethnic, racial, sexual, and cultural populations of the state. That is a legal requirement that the legislature produced and thought was important enough to put into statute. And I'm asking the legislature to consider that legal requirement in determining whether or not an appointment is appropriate. I would quibble a little bit with your statement, Representative Lynn, about not discriminating about where people come from within the state, because that same statute makes a firm requirement that there shall be at least one parole board member from the First Judicial District, at least one member from the Third Judicial District, and at least one member from the Second or Fourth Judicial District. And we have that requirement not because, I think explicitly, so that the board isn't dominated solely by voices from Anchorage or the South Central region. And it's not because that requirement embodies the belief that everybody from Anchorage is bad. It's because we believe that the parole board functions best when it has a wide variety of opinions, when it represents the broad spectrum of Alaskans. Not, again, someone from Southeast may simply have a different perspective and may have more insight into a particular case, into a particular parole nominee. Someone from Fairbanks or Nome might have a particular insight. And when we have a perspective from someone from Fairbanks and a perspective from someone from Southeast and a perspective from somebody from the Mat-Su Valley, the parole board works the best by having that diverse group of opinions from people who understand the whole state. So I think it would be appropriate for me to say if Ms. Pacenti were from the Third Judicial District and her nomination would leave the parole board with no one from the Second or Fourth District, I think it would be appropriate for me to draw that legal requirement to the committee's attention. And this is a similar statutory requirement. I do think it is concerning that we have a state where 18% of the population is Alaska Native, and 35-36% of the people in custody are Alaska Native. I do think it's concerning that we have a population of parolees and probationers that are 25% Alaska Native, but the people returned to prison are 43% Alaska Native. I'm not making any accusations. I'm not leveling any allegations. I'm asking tough questions, and I think it's appropriate for us to ask those tough questions.
Well, I wonder, what's the composition of the board now? I don't dig too deeply into this because I think it's a little off topic, but how many members of the parole board do we have, and is every judicial district represented in one way or another?
Yes, there are 5 members of the parole board. Currently, we have 3 representatives from the Third Judicial District, one from Kenai, one from Wasilla, and one from Anchorage. We have one from the First Judicial District, the former counsel for the Department of Corrections, who lives in Juneau. And Ms. Vicente would be the fifth member, and she's from Fairbanks, so she's from the 4th Judicial District.
Okay, so am I correct in all the districts are represented? Assuming that
If Ms. Vicente is reappointed, or someone else from the 2nd or 4th Judicial District is reappointed from the interior, roughly, yes, the composition would be appropriate under the requirement that all districts be represented. I was using that as an analogy towards this requirement that the government shall make appointments with due regard to the representation on the board of the ethnic, racial, and sexual and cultural populations of the state.
Okay. She's our only applicant today to look at. You may want to contact some member of our legislature, either in this body or the other body, who and express your concern to them, and they might wish to propose some sort of legislation, but I don't think it's within our jurisdiction here at this committee today to get into that. We are looking at the qualification of individual applicants for various boards, the Human Rights Board, in this case the Board of Parole, and we're looking at their particular qualification and some personal questions, some philosophical questions, and I don't see how this other issue, if it is an issue, it falls in our purview this morning. Would you agree?
I think the, as we saw earlier with the nominees, I think it was to the Human Rights Commission, the legislature, the committee can take the opportunity to ask questions about the functioning of the committee so that they understand better.
I think we did that.
And make its own inquiries for a wide variety of topics. Ultimately, the vote will be an up or down vote on the nominee, but I think the committee has broad authority to ask whatever questions it likes.
That's why I asked you my questions. This committee does not decide who does not get on one of these boards of commission. We merely forward the information on to a joint session of the House and the Senate. Anybody else on the committee's mind like to ask him any questions or make any comments? Representative Keller, Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree. I appreciate you bringing this forward and calling it to our attention. Well done, and we all heard you, but I agree with the chair that it is not really germane to whether or not we put this name forward. So, thanks.
Okay. Any closing comments? If so, I'm going to. Any closing comments, sir?
I think if we keep doing things the same way we're doing them, and we don't ask hard questions, and we don't look at these concerning statistics, nothing's going to change. And I think the committee may decide at this point that they're not going to push any further with regards to this applicant. I think our letter raises a lot of alarming statistics and a lot of real concerns. And I'd hope that that the committee will follow up on them appropriately.
I would hope that people are arrested in the first place if they commit a crime, whatever their race or ethnicity, and likewise, people are paroled or not paroled on a fact basis, not their ethnicity or race or whatever. Representative Keller had a follow-up here.
Thank you for bringing it forward, but I just have to point out on the record that this is not new information. We had the Department of Corrections and Judiciary, and there are a number of us struggling with how to respond appropriately to the alarming information that you brought forward. So again, thank you for repeating it and putting it on the record. I just don't want you to think or say that we're not concerned. So,
yeah, and I would ditto that. Thank you very much, sir, for calling in. Any other questions for Sarah Pacetti? If not, I'd like to thank you, Ms. Pacetti, and all the other folks who call in this morning, and to ACLU for also making your comments. And with that, is anybody else online who would like to testify? Anybody in the room would like to testify? I'm going to close public testimony at this point and go to the committee if you have any comments or anything like that. If not, we'll take a vote here.
So just
don't everybody speak at one time. Yes.
Just to be clear, Mr. Chair, so at this moment, looking at the human rights appointees, all three of them are currently serving, and we're just sending their names forward unless we object. And then on the parole board, the same goes for it. So,
Andrew, how our job here this morning at this hearing is to consider the qualifications of the various appointees with the goal. Then if we think those qualifications fit the minimum requirement, then we forward it on to a joint session of the House and the Senate, where there be up or down vote on all the names who've been appointed, who've been submitted and forwarded by the various committees.
Then on that, I have no objection myself, and each one of them have their own distinctive distinctivenesses and perspectives, and they appear all to be qualified to me to be serving in their capacity.
Would you care to make a motion, sir?
I move that we forward the names to the full legislative body for a confirmation vote.
Any objection? If not, we forward the names. Those names have all been forwarded, and thank you all for doing that. Now, our next meeting is Tuesday, March 5th, and we'll be hearing from Mr. Mark Mew. He's a governor appointee for the Alaska Police Standards Council. He was unable to call in this morning for very legitimate reasons. But we shall also be considering HB 113, Alaska Fire Standards Council, and HCR 3, Joint Committee on Federal Overreach. And any other business to come before the committee? Any comments from anybody? I'd like to thank everybody who participated, and have a great day.